C1A, number 22B.
We have learned in prayer the Lord and Fulton in spirit. Here we must use it. Here we must use it as a Mary and say, oh, what a wonderful thing. I can put my whole life away, my human life away, and start all new from that divine eternal origin where I was before Abraham was, namely the creation of life, capital L. And I begin to worship that, and I begin to nurture that. And though it's faintly developed, though I can hardly express it in words, though I only may feel it indistinctly, yes, but feel it already, let that be tender and warm to us. Then it puts to silence material law. It puts to silence that voice in us which says, yes, but after all, you have developed materially. Something funny happens, which is the wonder of love, that you don't ask anymore about after that. That something is so satisfied in us that one has always developed spiritually, that one never asks anymore about the material. It puts to silence, silently, the material sense in us. And only so could Jesus become the way shower. You see, she said that Jesus' advent in the flesh partook partly of Mary's earthly condition. So Jesus was endowed with the spirit without measure. And this is true to us. We become somehow a way shower because of this dual nature in us. Though we live a material life and a corporeal life with all sorts of things, with eating, drinking, clothing, working in a job, and so on, although we partake partly of earthly mother's life and condition, something in us is much more important. We are endowed with the divine spirit without measure. And that invisible spiritual development, that's the which is valuable. That's which we have to know. That's what makes man, what brings man into being. Then what happened? See, the first two subtones were Mary's standpoint. Only the third comes in Jesus Christ. Now she says that she in truth of soul, that Jesus, Christ Jesus, as an individual ideal of truth, came to bless everybody. He didn't obey the Mosaic law, that changeable law, where one moment you hate, the next moment you love. Now comes when that true manhood in us begins to take form, is conceived and becomes strangely developing itself, becomes stronger. Something in us, because we have lost that spiritual sense of manhood and not the material sense of manhood, because it has begun to silence the material sense of manhood, it comes to the point of steadiness in soul, of constancy in soul, where Jesus just couldn't do anything but be what he is, but to be divinely what he divinely is. And divinely he had to bless, no matter if he had to deal with friends or with enemies, with friends or with sinners, with saints or with sinners. His inward nature is constant and consistent. And so he remained what he is. His identity didn't change. He blessed saints and sinners. He was the friend of everyone. Now, you see, what I would like to show, you see, is that there are not three steps like this. Where we say, now I have done the second, now I must be constant about it, and I must only bless, and I mustn't curse anybody. It isn't that. It's development. Just as one day grows out of the next day, just as tomorrow grows out of today, just as we are tomorrow because of what we are today. So the spiritual development is an unbroken link. And it's always ushering in the next thing. Let's go over these first three subtones again. Because our being, we give birth to our being. It's worthwhile going over it and over it and over it. That point where in our sense of atonement we have come to see that there is only one life, that there are not many lives. And that therefore our unity is the unity with the one life, which is God. And therefore we are ready to put away a material sense of life. Then there comes truth. Then, in the measure as you are merry and perceive consciously, sincerely, only that live which is from God, that never could anything live which was not from God, we begin to realize that therefore only that which flows out from life, God, is man. And so perceiving this idea of God as the only author of man, I begin to feel, well, that brings me the Savior. That brings me the solution to all my human problems, because I am not human, I am the divine idea. But I can't stop there, because viewing, conceiving this idea says, well, if you are idea, you cannot be material. And so I come to truth of spirit. It begins to put the silence that I have ever been materially created, that my identity has ever been material, or has material at all. See, the idea of truth of mind itself begins to talk to me and ushers in truth of spirit and says, well, then, if you are idea, you have never had a material background, never a material origin, never a material past, never a material life. It puts to silence the material sense and order of generation. Well, as I begin to love that and worship that and begin to see how that is a saving process, and that separates me from a material sense and an erroneous sense of development, where I naturally are ushered into a third stage of truth of soul, where I say, well, if there are not two, there is only one, so I can't help but stay with the one. I can't but stay with the nature of God. And that's what Jesus did. He stayed with the nature of God. He blessed everybody. He didn't ask. He couldn't but be what he was, divine. And so he only could express his nature as he was. But if we do that, see, as in us grows that sense that only that is man which is the idea of God, and that man is always the outflow of God, and therefore is always worthwhile being blessed, and that we just jolly well can't help but bless the idea of God, the thought broadens out to truth as principle, where we say, well, then really we have only one realm of manhood. We have only man as man. We have only man as idea of man, and the whole realm is man. And that's what he said. He said, Jesus acknowledged no ties of the flesh. He only called one his Father, God, and therefore he called only those brethren and sisters and mothers and so on who do the will of God. He created quite a new realm of manhood, a brotherhood of men, which he began to see that I don't have to deal with bodies and persons, but with that principal state of mind everywhere which has accepted but one God. It gives quite a new, wide sense of man. Where inwardly in one feels, well, with whomever I have to deal with, I never have to deal with human beings or mortals, but I always have to deal with ideas of God obedient to principle. Now, in this realm, naturally, no two-legged animal has any place. As the dinner you would say, it's free from corporeality and free from personality. And then comes the crucial point again. Always when it comes to life in the Atonement and Eucharist, it comes to the crucial point. The crucial point is that it is very shown that in the measure, as we atone with this principle of manhood and begin to see that only that is man which is obedient to this principle, they who do the will of God, I call only that man and brethren and sister who do the will of God, I begin to realize that I am only man insofar as I only let myself be used by principle, that only then I live the life of man, that only then I begin to act and live and express and exhibit and exemplify the life of man, of real man, and I only do that which principle asks me to do. That's the sacrament. Here she comes in with the sacrament, where we begin to realize that therefore then we have to be willing to let go of our way of life, that we have to let go of that life which we deem to be the right life, which we hope it would be the right life, which we would like to be the right life, which we think ours to be the right side, that we all, that we let all that go. There, that comes in the characters of great magnitude. That's where the bitterness of the experience comes in. That's why she couples the sacrament and the Eucharist with the bitter experience. It's only bitter because it touches the core of our human error, of our human life, and the error of the human life. See, principle says, I am life. Principle says, nothing is life but principle. Principle says, therefore, personal life is not life. A life which is born and created by a human wish, by a human attitude, by a worldly attitude, by a traditional attitude, by a common sense attitude. All that life which is born out of that source is not life, not life. Principle says only that list which is principle. And that is where Jesus' soul would be the difficulty for every one of us. That's the sacrament where he said, now drink, take of this bread, the bread from heaven. It's a divine heavenly supply. But you must drink the cup, and you must drink the cup and drain it to the dregs. You must drink it, and he said, drink ye all of it. And the cup symbolizes the bitter experience, he said, which shows that nothing enters life, capital L, nothing enters God, life, the realm of life, capital L, but that which is principled life. And everything else has to be let out, has to be kept out. That's the point where we struggle. We struggle because we don't want to let go of the false sense of life. And we don't want to let it go, not because we are unliving, so to say, but because century or million-year-old tradition clings on us and has established an erroneous concept which is so impregnated in our mind and life and feeling and attitude and ambition and purpose that we seem to have struggled to let it go. That's why it takes such a long period or so many paragraphs to dwell on this crucial point of truth and life. Because each one of us knows that's the crucial point. And it was the crucial point for Jesus. If you remember the Gospel of Matthew, you will remember how very early in the Gospel already Jesus began to talk to his disciples and say, the Son of Man has to go. I must go to Jerusalem. I must be crucified because the Son of Man has to go. And after chapters he comes again and says, the Son of Man has to go. I have to go to Jerusalem. And time after time he said that. Matthew would show us, even for Jesus, it was a big thing to swallow. It was a big demonstration. It was actually that demonstration which the Old Testament has never done. The Old Testament has never done that. It has not, except for some prophets like Deutero Isaiah, have never seen that that has to be done. And Jesus came to prove life, the life of man. And he could only prove the life of man by laying down every phase of mortal life. He couldn't prove life just by showing that God is life. That wasn't his job. His job was much bigger. He had to prove that God is life by being willing to atone with this one life and showing that he is atoning with this one life by letting go every phase of the human sense of life. That was his crucifix, which really started years before. Only mounted up to that symbol of crucifix. But inwardly it was a long process of how to have dominion. You see, in truth of life you have in Genesis that man has dominion over the earth. Where we get dominion over the mortal sense of life and then are willing to lay it down, then, only then, if you get it all further to truth of truth, only then you will see how she comes to truth of truth, where really manhood comes into full light, into full blossom, so to say. It's there where she begins to, with this holy struggle, is the first side note, the holy struggle, where she shows that his holy struggle was not to struggle to be one with God. That's what he was always. But his only struggle was to struggle to be willing to let down all that doesn't belong to God. That's our struggle. Fundamentally, we are always the Son of God. But what we have to exemplify is that we are willing to let go our false atoning, an atonement with a false sense of man that we have to exemplify. And so yet the holy struggle, when the human element in him struggled with the divine, he said, not my will, but thine be done. The sense, the human sense, capitulated entirely. Then he ushered in truth as truth. And that tone of truth as truth is given there in a beautiful way.
Again,
she says in the next paragraph, she has a side note called incisive question. You know, incisive question. One just sees how it goes for one's bone and flesh. And if you, there are six incisive questioners. And if you read them, you will see they all turn around the same point spiritually. They all turn around the same point spiritually, namely showing, are you willing to drink the cup? Are you willing to drink the cup and take up the cross? In every way, in all shapes and forms, she put six questions all around six points. Are you willing to give up that struggle, to lay down the mortal? Then, when this is answered, then she says, yes, if we do, then we need no other commemoration. Because then, and now she comes and puts it again in italics, say italics, in italics, and says, then we need no other commemoration, but then it's the millennial glory for all who had drunk the cup. What would that have done? Says, that would have revolutionized the world. He did it. He revolutionized the world. We haven't. But he has. He has through what? Through laying down the mortal sense of life. That's all what he did. And that had that enormous effect that for 2,000 years afterwards on the whole world, in every corner of the world, in every house and in every country and through all the years and days, his effect is still at work. It revolutionized the world. And it would bring in the millennium. You know, the vice and the bigness of the fact what we will achieve when we are laying down the mortal is enormous. Or, she says, and through all what the disciples experience, now she goes over to the disciples, she says, that's what the disciples see. They experienced, you see, the cup to a small degree. They experienced it. And it had effect, and it was, they became more spiritual. This has even effect on the disciples. They became more spiritual. They understood better what their master had taught. And Jesus' resurrection became their resurrection. You see the penetration of truth that comes out the moment we lay down the mortal. As it says, it has not only effect on us. No, the effect is on the universe, on being, because it's God with us, and it's no more God with me. There's no more me. There is us. There is being. There is wholeness. There is immensity. And it helps them to raise themselves and others from spiritual dullness and blind belief in God into the perspective of infinite possibility. Now, can we picture out something bigger as men than the perception of infinite possibilities? I couldn't picture out a bigger structure, a bigger form for man as the fact of being that man is perception of infinite possibilities. That's man. Well, what has that to do with a corporeal mortal? What has that to do with a person who is 20 years old or 80 years old? What has that to do if one is English or Swiss or American? What that has to do if one lives in this century or in another century? That has nothing to do. Man is idea. Now, we can see that this what she presents here is not a promise or is not a hypothesis. What she presents here first is that it is possible because she exemplifies it and illustrates it through Jesus' work, that he did it, and showing that he just used the principle, which is the principle of all. It is a principle and therefore not a personal thing of Jesus. Therefore, it is something which is applicable to us. And not only that, she not only shows it's possible and it's a fact, but the beauty of it, the bigness of it, I think, is that she shows how to arrive at that fact. What would it be of any use to us if we would only have Jesus' life as he lived it, and we wouldn't see how to arrive at that fact? Then we would take Jesus and say, well, he's a jolly big fellow. He was a wonderful man. He was a big caliber. And that's that. But science, bigger than that. Science comes in and says, now I show you the way. That's the comfort. That's why science is the comforter. It comes in and says, now I show you the way. and you can go the way. And nothing can stop you to go the way. And I show you the way orderly. And if you go the way orderly, one step just leads you to the next. The last point in it is Truth of Love, where she shows, where she no more speaks of Jesus. At this point, she no more speaks of Jesus. The whole focal point of that last tone shifts, really, from Jesus to the universe, becomes universal. In the focus of that last tone of Truth of Love, it's surely called perfection and womanhood, the focal point shifts on the disciples, and then on the Christian scientist, and then the whole last paragraph is our baptism, our church, our Eucharist, our. You see, showing that man, the manhood of Jesus is present, that the manhood of Jesus is not something which belongs to him, that the manhood of Jesus is a universal fact, the idea, the perfect idea of God. That what we experience as Christian scientists is just a reflection of Jesus' true universal manhood, which also shows that if we go the way of manhood through these stones, that our true manhood is eternal, that our true manhood is just as much manhood and is just as much at work and is just as much blessing and doing good in 1,000 years and in 2,000 years and in 10,000 years, because time is no longer. It's a fact. Can you perceive of man as something bigger than what it shows here? As the birth of man. See, we will never, afterwards, in later chapters, it shows the metaphysical aspect of man. Here, as I don't think ever in a textbook anymore, it shows the birth of manhood. How we can be merry and give birth to our manhood. But showing really bigness of our man. But we talk.